Good morning, and welcome to another Tuesday edition of The Morning Show, Community Conversations, playing here live on KRFY. As always, if you want to listen to the entire interview and have to step out midway, you can listen to a podcast of the show later on at krfy.org. I'm Phil Huff, your host for this Tuesday. My usual host, Julie Calamine, is stuck somewhere between here and Minneapolis. Hopefully she's still warm and dry in the Minneapolis airport, winging her way back to Sandpoint someday soon. We're delighted this morning to have with us on the show folks from the Lands Council, one of our regional conservation organizations, to talk about the work they do across the broad region, with some specific emphasis on the programs that affect or impact our neighborhood in North Idaho. With us today are Adam Gribauer, Public Lands Program Director, and Kat Hall, Restoration Program Director for the Lands Council. Good morning and welcome, Adam and Kat.
Thanks, Phil.
Thanks, Phil.
So we'd like to start with an overview of the organizations that are on the show. Tell us a little bit, one of you, if you would, about the Lands Council, the mission, the history of how it got started, the geographic area you serve, things of that nature.
I can start that. Adam, feel free to jump in. So Lands Council is a nonprofit organization based in downtown Spokane. Our mission is to preserve and revitalize the forests, water, and wildlife of the Inland Northwest. And we do that through things like grassroots activism, advocacy, community engagement, education, and many of the field-based activities that Adam and I are super excited to talk to you all about today. We were founded in 1983 by a small group of doctors who at the time were seeing the tie between a sustainable or unsustainable environment and sustainable, unsustainable community. So we've been around for quite a long time. We currently have a staff of, I think there are 8 of us, so pretty small. We have a number of different programs ranging from forest policy to wildlife management to on the ground restoration to watershed management, climate change activism. And it's a fun organization. It's great to be part of, and we're really, really psyched and honored to be here with you and on this show today.
Yeah, it's a great summary. Just add that a lot of our work started with the Clearwater National Forest. So over there in Idaho, and we do expand our reach to Idaho and Western Montana for some of our projects.
You know, we live in an interesting region where these state lines drawn straight north and south along sort of imaginary boundaries don't really reflect the topography or geography, physical or cultural of the area. There's so much that Northern Idaho and Northwestern Montana share that it really makes sense to look broadly at the landscape. It sounds like that's what the Lands Council has been doing for some time.
Yeah, definitely. It's nice to have a regional focus, the Inland Northwest. Fortunately, thanks to our membership, we've got well over 1,000 members, donations that we get from folks, grants that we're able to write and get. That's what enables us to do all this important work over such a large area and covering so many broad topics.
We want to dive into some of those programs in a moment or two, but first let's get to know each of you a little better. Our longtime listeners know we have a lot of conservation folks on the show, and I think this is the first time for both of you. So tell us a little bit about yourselves, your role at the Lands Council, and how long you've been there, how you got engaged in this kind of work. And Kat, why don't we start with you?
Sure. Well, I've been at the Lands Council for 14 years now and never saw that coming, but here I am. I'm from New York originally, went to college in upstate New York, got a bachelor's in natural resources, and then spent roughly 4 years in the Peace Corps in West Africa doing agroforestry extension. Came back and jumped on a quick flight out to Southeast Alaska, where I worked for a youth corps doing environmental education and trail maintenance, and then did a number of different things ranging from working on a fishing boat to doing trail maintenance with the Forest Service to working at a fish hatchery, to ultimately working for an organization called the Southeast East Alaska Conservation Council, which is very similar to the Lands Council. And it's through SEAC that I heard of the Lands Council and eventually moved down to the Inland Northwest and got the job here. I've always been passionate about the environment, about being outside, about doing things that benefit our environment and benefit the lives of people. And in this position, that's pretty much what I get to do every day. So honored to be part of this organization, to have been part of it, and I'm really excited about the direction that the organization is taking, the staff that we have, the projects that we're working on, and the funding that we've been able to secure.
Excellent. And Adam, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, so I'm fairly new to the Lands Council as an employee. Just started back in October, I think it was. Seemed like a long time ago. But I've volunteered with them for probably 8 or so years now. I'm also from the East Coast, from New Jersey originally, but quickly realized that was not necessarily the place for me, not enough space. I have a degree in wildlife biology, and one of my seasonal jobs during my undergrad was to work in Republic for the Forest Service. That's how I first kind of got engaged in this region. And then had a bunch of seasonal or wildlife related jobs. I've tracked grouse in the Southwest in New England. I've trapped tadpoles in New England and in this region. So just kind of went the seasonal wildlife gig for a long time, but I've also done a lot of environmental education and wilderness trip leading. Most of that has been in the Southwest. And then I finally moved out here to get my master's, focusing more on riparian and plant ecology. And the last 9 or so years, I've been working with the Upper Columbia United Tribes, doing a long-term monitoring program on some of their mitigation properties, as well as a forestry study. And so I get to use a lot of those connections in my current job, which is great.
Excellent. And so with your role involving public lands, let's delve a little bit more into what exactly that means and how you make an impact on public lands. Let's look at that in some detail. What are your main focuses? What are the threats and opportunities that the Lands Council faces?
Yeah, so one of the great things is we do have a lot of public land in this area, in this region, particularly just in the West in general. So it's one of the reasons I translocated out to the West is because of that public land aspect. Particularly with the Lands Council, again, we started as a kind of a forestry specific organization, and we've expanded greatly from there, but we still deal a lot in the national forests and what the national forest is up to. So that's one of my main parts of my position is to work with the Northeast Washington Forest Collaborative, just starting to engage with some of the other forest collaboratives around. And so people who aren't familiar, they kind of came out of the timber wars of the 90s when there's a lot of conflict between environmentalists, forestry industry, as well as the National Forest Service. And so these collaborations are kind of bringing all those players together to work for a common goal. So recreation, conservation, timber industry, all kind of coming to the table and having conversations about how we can all reach similar goals and have practices that are that work well for all those parties. So that's a big part of my work. I think with ongoing climate change and climate issues, forest practices have another layer of complexity and importance to them because we are more and more realizing how important our forests are to mitigating climate change and storing carbon and sequestering carbon. So those are pretty important aspects of my job. I also recreate heavily and have been a wilderness trip leader for a long time. So a lot of what I'd like to focus on and excited about this position is just kind of spreading the word about the wonderful public lands that we have around here, how to utilize them respectfully, particularly with COVID. It seems like every trailhead you go to, there's 2 to 3 times as many cars as there used to be. So there's a lot more people on the landscape using these places, which is great. We just have to kind of realize how to use it respectfully and share those places with all the different user groups as well.
So tell us a little more about, and you're showing up in collaboratives. One of the focuses is climate change and forest health. What are some of the proposals you're making or goals or gains you hope to achieve through that process for climate health?
Yeah, so the Lands Council particularly and a lot of other conservation organizations would like to see more wilderness in the region. So that's one of the focuses, but also it's just timber management practices. So a big question is how many large trees are on the landscape? It's not really an answer that the Forest Service has readily available. They just don't have the info. It just seems like we just need more data on a lot of the aspects of our forests. And so large trees are carbon storage. New forests are sequestering a lot of carbon. We know in the past, our forests were a good mosaic of different age stands and different tree species. And particularly with forest fires, they are not going away. These are fire-dependent ecosystems. So we have to learn to live with them better and manage our forests to be more resilient to fires. So it's kind of a complex issue, but we're learning more. We're understanding better how to manage forests, how to both get economic value out of our forests, get recreation value out of our forests, but also how to conserve them and make them more resilient to both a warmer climate and more fires that are on the landscape and are going to be on the landscape.
It's a big topic for sure. And you mentioned the Northeastern Washington Forestry Coalition. There's some other active ones in our area. Have you become or plan on becoming active with the Panhandle Forest Collaborative or the Kootenai Forest stakeholders or any of the others?
Yeah, I'm planning on attending the Panhandle meeting in a couple of weeks here. Definitely been getting all the emails. I've only been in this position for a couple of months, so trying to get my feet under me in a lot of aspects. But I do plan on attending those and getting a better understanding of kind of what's happening in all those different collaboratives.
It takes time. It's literally a large landscape, a big footprint that you've taken on in terms of the volume of public lands that are present in this geographic area we described at the beginning, from Northeast Washington to Northwestern Montana and Idaho in between. There are millions and millions of acres of public lands. So I want to come back to Kat for a little bit here and hear more about the restoration programs plural, that you've been working on. And there's a few that have been in the media lately, at least in my list of emails from the Lands Council and others. But tell us maybe broadly about the restoration program.
Yeah, so when we talk about our riparian restoration program, the way that I see it is composed of two aspects, streamside tree plantings and these things called beaver dam analogs. And we're able to do this and have been able to do it for many years, thanks to some funding from the EPA Section 319 grant program of the Clean Water Act, which is the non-point source pollution section. It's distributed through the Washington Department of Ecology, so we're limited to doing our work in the state of Washington, and we're primarily around the Spokane area. But basically, what this grant focuses on is planting streamside vegetation and doing activities in the stream in order to convey water quality benefits. So I'll start with the tree planting that we do. What we are able to go out in the field and do is plant native trees and shrubs in anywhere from 35 to 75 foot buffer strips, so hugging both sides of the creek, in order to do three really, really good things for the water. First is to stabilize the soil and prevent erosion. Second is to essentially provide a buffer from any pollutants that might be running down hills, off of farms, along roads into the creek. And by that, I mean things like pesticides, fertilizers, any kind of herbicides, nutrients, etc. The third benefit is that this vegetation will, when it gets older, shade the creek, cool the temperatures of the water, allow for more dissolved oxygen, which benefits macroinvertebrates and fish, and just generally provide better habitat. So much of our restoration work has largely focused on the installation of riparian buffers until more recently, where we've added these really awesome things called beaver dam analogs to our repertoire. And a beaver dam analog is essentially a human-made beaver dam. And in order to sort of explain this, I just need to say a few of the benefits of real beaver dams. So when a beaver comes in and builds a dam along a stream, the dam will basically stop or slow the water, create a pond, and that will do, again, three really, really good things for the local environment. It'll help to slow that flow, recharge the aquifer, and create more storage. It will improve water quality. Typically, water that goes through a beaver dam is cleaned of things like sediment, for example. The sediment settles out in the upstream end of the beaver dam, and so the water that goes through it is cleaner. And then finally, the ponds and the wetlands that are created by beavers are really, really great habitat for a number of different critters. Not to mention the benefits that beaver dams have, which we're seeing more recently now, as it applies to things like climate change and wildfires. When we have a wildfire that rips through the land, it's been shown that wet beaver meadows stay green and resist that burning, which is really, really important. And beaver dams, just they're able to sequester carbon. They're able to also, by working with wildfires, they're able to help to basically mitigate climate change. So the other thing that beaver dams are able to do, and this fits in really, really well with the restoration work, is that we tend to build these dams on incised creeks. So creeks that have been ditched, channelized, they have lost their habitat value. I mentioned the beaver dam settling out sediment. What can happen is that sediment that is coming down from the upper watershed is able to gradually settle out behind this complex of beaver dams, and it's able to slowly raise the elevation of that channel to hopefully reconnect it to the floodplain and allow for a more restored ecosystem. So this works really well, as we've seen with the riparian plants that we install. Lots of times we have issues with invasive species. When these streams are ditched and channelized, they tend to naturally become even deeper with the flows that happen every winter, every spring. And so what that does is it drags the water table down with it. And that is where the invasives come in. They'll outcompete the native vegetation. So we're essentially doing the opposite. We're building these BDA complexes to help settle out that sediment, raise the elevation of that channel to bring it closer to the floodplain, hopefully connect it, bring the water table up with it, and then that will serve the native vegetation that we plant. So the fact that we're able to do these BDAs now in concert with the riparian buffers is just a really wonderful thing, because we've struggled a lot with, you know, keeping some of our newly planted trees alive because the water table is just so deep and because it's been such a degraded system. So we're really excited about being able to use these two techniques in concert with each other and to start seeing the really, really awesome benefits that they both convey.
So I have a couple of questions that this brings to mind. And one of them is, why not just bring back beavers?
That is a great question. And so many people ask that question. And the short answer to that is that typically the streams that we're working on, they may or may not have had beaver in the past. They've certainly been impacted by humans. They tend to not have the habitat that beaver need. So if you picture a ditch, literally a ditch going through ag land, which has farms on one side, maybe invasive reed canary grass on the other side, that is not a place that a beaver is going to be able to survive. There's just not enough food. So the hope is that, and that's one of the beauties of BDAs. You know, it's like there are so many miles of stream that would benefit from beaver and from what they do, but they can't support the beaver right now because there isn't the habitat. Well, if we come in with these BDAs, it's like the next best thing to having beaver. We can put in these dams and get the benefits of them without having beaver. And then hopefully in the future, because of the dams, because of what they do in creating a wetter environment, when the native species start to appear, like the ultimate dream, the ultimate goal is that beavers will actually return to that area. So
if you build it, the beavers will come.
Yeah.
Something like that. Long-term thinking. The thing I'm thinking is, unlike the focus that Adam has on public lands, so much of our riparian habitat's in the hands of private owners. You mentioned agricultural lands, and here in Bonner County, we have Lake Pend'Oreille, which is a mix of public and private property, and the riparian buffer zone is one that's managed oftentimes by individuals outside of the public domain. And so tell us how that layers complexity onto your work.
Just working with private landowners or?
Right. Yes.
Yeah. So, you know, so the couple of thoughts here. Most of our work is done on private land. So that requires us to find a willing landowner, you know, to let us come onto the property and plant trees and basically flood their land out. So that's been a challenge for us. We would like to be able to do more of this work on these agricultural lands. And we've struggled so far in getting through to the big ag producers in trying to, get onto the land, get onto the pieces of property that are in the most need of this restoration. So, you know, the actual on the ground restoration work is one piece of it, but just involving the landowners and having that piece is absolutely essential to what we do. And in some ways that's the most challenging part. With the grants that we have now, we're actively looking for sites in the area for, you know, landowners who are interested in doing this project and working with us. And so it's a lot. There's a lot of pieces that go on in to make this all happen.
I know there's been a lot of work done here more locally in Bonner County through the Native Plant Society's work with the county planning zone and local landowners. Looking at the setbacks necessary from streams and lakes and encouraging the treatment of that buffer zone with native plants as a better way to retain the runoff.
Yeah.
So, wow, so much going on. And I think, Adam, I forgive you if you talked about this, but I don't recall hearing it. I know recently I came out on a field trip you led that was looking at a biochar demonstration program, which I think falls probably somewhere between the restoration and the public lands program. So if you or Kat or both would like to talk a little bit about the biochar, I thought it was very interesting. What's going on or what's potentially going on with that?
Sure. Yeah. There is a lot of interest around biochar lately. So the Lands Council's role with that is looking at reducing kind of small acreage fuel loads through the production of biochar. So generally a small landowner would go through and thin out their trees as a way to reduce fire potential for their property and create slash piles, and those slash piles would be burned basically to ash. But through the project that we've been working on, which has just been a pilot project to see how instead of just burning that slash entirely is converting it into biochar. And for those who don't know, biochar is a kind of a very specific product that is produced from a high heat, low oxygen environment. And then you kind of interrupt that burning process before it's complete. So you end up with a very high carbon product at the end of it. And that product has a lot of really good agricultural properties, as well as forest restoration properties. It can help remediate logging roads and logging platforms because of the properties of biochar. So it is extremely porous. So it has a tremendous water holding capacity. It creates a really good environment for soil, flora and fauna, to do some remediation of pollutants if used in that way. And it's a very long lasting substance, so 100 to thousands of years. So you're actually sequestering a large portion of the carbon from that slash pile into this biochar that's then returned to the soil. So there's definitely a lot of interest in the agricultural region for this to get more carbon back into soils, particularly in wheat farming, but also in a lot of orchard farming and viticulture and winemaking.
Yeah, it was a fascinating concept, and I think one that we're going to be hearing more about in the not too distant future as it's applied across the landscape, both for forestry and agricultural practices.
Yeah, it seems to be there's still a lot of questions about how best to go about it. And there's different scales that this could be utilized. So it could be a large scale operation like a biomass fuels production, or it could be as small as, you know, a couple acreage. We have come up with some roadblocks, particularly with certain counties and their clean air agency restrictions. So like right here in Spokane County, we cannot use the equipment we have, but we can use it in other counties in Washington. There is a labor aspect to the process, but there are a lot of people that would more than happily do this on their own property if they had the equipment. And so that's kind of what we've been hearing is a lot of people are excited to do this or try it out. There's also business potential that a lot of people are looking at of how to get this product that's probably created in a forest environment out to agricultural providers.
Nice. Well, let's see. So what else is going on that we haven't touched on in terms of projects or community engagement? I seem to recall, at least just before the pandemic hit, that the Lands Council was doing a really active tree planting program in Spokane. Is that still going on, Kat?
Well, in addition to the riparian planting that I talked about, we have a really awesome newish project called Spokanopy. And unlike our riparian restoration, which plants hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of very small seedlings, in this project, we plant large trees. So trees that could be 10, 15 feet tall. We plant them in certain neighborhoods in Spokane that have been identified to be low income and of low canopy cover. So the idea is to do some outreach with the neighbors in these areas, get them on board, let them know what we're doing. And then if they're interested, they end up deciding to work with us and we are able to plant a tree on their curb or on their property. And they get to be part of it if they're interested and if they're available. We get volunteers in addition to staff members and other community members to come out and plant those trees. So it turns out to be a really, really amazing community building activity, neighborhood beautification. These large trees are going to take up hundreds of thousands of gallons of contaminated stormwater runoff, preventing that runoff from entering our Spokane River. And it's increasing our canopy coverage, which, like I said, in these neighborhoods is lacking. And as we're seeing, when we have these very hot summers, not unlike this past summer, where we had that stretch of 100 plus degree temperatures, street trees are pretty necessary, and they provide a huge cooling effect, not to mention all the other benefits they provide, including increasing real estate values, et cetera. So this project has really taken off. Chelsea Updegrove in our office is the one that's been behind that. And she's really created a pretty amazing program, which is expanding. We have a close partnership with the city of Spokane in doing this. And we've got grant funding from another ecology grant, a public participation grant, which is going to give us the opportunity to plant 200 of these urban street trees over the next three planting seasons. So starting this spring, and then into the fall, and then into the following spring. So yeah, a project that, again, there's so much benefit in it. And we're very, very excited to do it and to grow it as much as we can in the city.
very exciting. Nice. You know, it's January of a new year, and it's always a little hard to predict the year. And of course, COVID's still going on. It makes it even cloudier in some ways. But tell us about upcoming events or activities or opportunities to engage the public in 2022.
Yeah, well, probably the soonest upcoming event is going to be a snowshoe hike that we'll be leading. And we just actually talked about this yesterday. We've got it scheduled for Saturday, February 19th, and we call it our Winter Wander Wild hike, where we invite community members to meet us up at Mount Spokane. And there's a trail that we do that sort of goes through the forest to a warming shelter. I usually dig a snow pit and give a demonstration and talk about snow science and the impacts of climate change on our mountain snowpack and such. And we point things out along the way in the trail, and then we kind of go back. It forms a nice loop. So that has been scheduled for Saturday, February 19th. And this isn't firm yet, but we always have an Earth Day tree planting, which usually happens this Saturday, either before or after Earth Day. Not totally sure what that's going to be. It's possible that it could be a Spokanopy project. This year, in the past, it's always been our streamside restoration, and it could still be that. We're kind of working out the details, but as soon as we have that figured out, that'll be on all of our social media. And that's a really great event where we encourage anybody and everybody to come. Families are welcome. It's a very kid-friendly event. And it's just a really nice way to spend a Saturday morning, and great way to celebrate Earth Day. And then I guess the other event that we have is our annual auction fundraiser, which is scheduled this year for April 16th. And I don't have a whole lot of details about that. Our development team is starting to get going on that, but that's a really popular event. That's a great way for folks to get together, and it really helps support the programs we, you know, rely on and appreciate so much, those donations that we get from the auction.
And this year, are you hoping that that will be a live event, or is it likely to be online only?
The last 2 years it's been online. I think the hope is that we get to do it live this year, but we'll just have to kind of monitor the situation and see where things go and see where we're at.
So for people wanting more information or knowing how to sign up, is there a contact page or a website you can direct them to?
Yeah, our website's really great way to go. It's www.landscouncil.org. And Adam, what's the other social media addresses or links you know?
We have an Instagram and a Facebook. I think the Instagram is just Lands Council. Neither of us are very social media savvy. So,
I'm sure
other people for that.
I'm sure they'll pop up in any search for the Lands Council. Well, before we sign off, any closing thoughts, things we didn't talk about you'd like to mention before we go? And then we'll do our goodbyes. Kat, how about we start with you?
I just really appreciate, Phil, the opportunity to be on your show and to get to let folks in the Sandpoint area know about the work we're doing. I've worked a little bit with SOL, the Selkirk Outdoor Leadership Expedition, and I know they do fantastic work up there, and the whole Sandpoint area is very, very well taken care of by SOL and all the great people that work there, which is awesome. And yeah, we're just, like I said before, we're really thrilled with where our organization is at and the things that we're doing and the people that are part of it. And we like to let other people know, and we encourage folks to come join us on our events. That's one of the greatest things that we do, I think, just getting outside with volunteers and with community members, getting our hands dirty, getting our feet wet, and doing really, really good things for the environment. So I definitely would encourage folks to check out our website and come join us, get a firsthand look at the things we do. And yeah, again, Phil, thank you so much for giving us this airtime and the opportunity to be part of your home up there.
Thank you, Kat. Adam, any final thoughts from you?
Yeah, I also want to thank you for involving us in this program. I'm excited with this new position. I think there's a lot of work to be done in the region. Excited to bring some of my contacts, particularly working with the tribes, into my new role. I have to say, starting at the Lands Council in the fall is a very exciting time to start at the Lands Council. We probably planted almost 3,000 trees in the fall as an organization. It might have been more than that. One particular event that Kat didn't mention, but it is in the fall. It's one of our biggest volunteer events is our Reforest Spokane Day. And we worked with the Inland Northwest Land Conservancy this year, and we worked with U.S. Fish and Wildlife to put that on. And so I'm not sure how many volunteers we had, but it's probably near 200. Kat might have a better idea of that, but that's one of our biggest volunteer events of the year. And so with that alone, we planted, I think, 17,000 trees. And then with the addition of a lot of other tree planting. So it was definitely a busy time and exciting time to join the Lands Council and get outside and dig a lot of holes and get dirty.
Good way to get your hands dirty. That's a lot of trees. But well, once again, we want to thank you for coming on the Community Conversations on KRFY. We've enjoyed listening to more in-depth information about the Lands Council from our two guests this morning, Adam Gebauer, Public Lands Program Director, and Kat Hall, the Restoration Program Director for the Lands Council. And as always, if you tuned in partway and want to listen to the entire interview, you can go to krfy.org later on in the day and download the podcast. We hope to have you back next Tuesday for Community Conversations on the Morning Show.